Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Welcome to Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson. On our program today, the DREAM Act, signed into legislation by California Governor Jerry Brown. Why some believe the legislation will make it tougher to pass real immigration reform. We talked to syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete. And is the bad economy behind a rise in some child abuse cases? A report from correspondent Shelley Bronco. Plus, the Valley's newest literary giants, brothers Burley and Abel Vang. But first, the DREAM Act. California's governor signed it into law earlier this month. It will allow students who are undocumented immigrants to qualify for state-funded financial aid for college. The Department of Finance estimates that 2,500 students will qualify for Cal grants at a cost of $14.5 million. The bill will also provide financial aid in the form of community college district fee waivers and institutional aid from CSU and UC schools. Here to discuss the issue with us right now is Thomas Holyoke, a professor at Fresno State.
Hello, Juanita.
Our first question is with this, from what I've read, there are a lot of people who are opposed to this act on a number of fronts, and not just the fact that it provides state-funded financial aids, but the fact that there is no path to citizenship with this.
That's right. In this, it gets a little confusing because there's a lot of this gets caught up with something called the Federal DREAM Act, which is legislation that would actually make it possible for people who've been in the United States who may have originally come from Mexico when they were children but have been living in the United States most of their lives. The Federal DREAM Act would have allowed them to become permanent residents if they had completed a university degree or military service with an honorable discharge. But that's not what the California DREAM Act does. In fact, the California DREAM Act could not do that because, you know, the decisions on granting permanent residency status, that's purely in the hands of the federal government. California has no legal authority there.
So someone asks why pass a piece of legislation that on the face of it, you would have students getting state-funded financial aid to complete college, but then could not legally work in this country?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. First off, I think there's still a great deal of hope that there will be a federal DREAM Act at some point, and more and more pressure is now being put on President Obama to commit to doing that, particularly now that President Obama is going into a rough election year next year, that I think some groups feel that they can pressure him a lot more to prioritize the Federal DREAM Act, and there's been some criticism that he has failed to do so. And the other part of that is, you know, enforcement of immigration laws has been going up actually somewhat in the United States, but to a large extent, you know, I guess the group of people we refer to as the undocumented are a substantial portion of California's population. And the question is, you know, how do we treat that population as a state? What the California DREAM Act does is it decides that we're going to invest. And what we do not want to create is some kind of a permanent underclass. Instead, we're going to invest the resources and the time in making sure that everybody in the state has, you know, at least an opportunity for a good education. And the way the nation's changing at the moment, you are just not going to be able to have a good job and a good future, if you have any job at all, if you do not have a college education. And, you know, the jobs of the future are going to require people who are well-trained.
That is so true. But the issue being is that we still have not addressed the whole issue of undocumented either workers or students or, you know, people being in the country. So you pass legislation without addressing the issue itself.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, again, California's doing what it can. The broader immigration issue and the issue of legalization, you know, California, there's nothing California can do about that. That's purely a matter for the federal government.
Well, you know, there are some people that I've spoken with who are concerned. I mean, they support rights and immigration reform, especially for the undocumented residents here in California. But their concern being is that legislation like this, they think, might create a backlash to make it even tougher to move forward real immigration reform. And that people see that feel that there is something, you know, wrong with providing undocumented students access to state-funded aid.
Well, if I understand the question right, I think it's true that an incremental approach to major policy change often fails to achieve its goal. Usually, it's easier to bring about significant, far-reaching policy change when you have a major crisis going on. And when states like California pass something like the DREAM Act, or other states that have done something similar, like Texas, it gives the impression that, well, if the problem's not entirely solved, well, it's largely solved, and we can turn our attention elsewhere.
There is already an effort underway to get the measure on the ballot to be repealed next year. Do you think that's a real possibility, considering the climate right now?
Well, at this point, I would probably not expect to see that happen. I mean, yes, it's possible to get a referendum with 500,000 signatures to overturn it. As you know, at least I've been understanding it, that effort is not gone anywhere in California, that those who want to get the referendum together, get the signatures, have had a great deal of trouble raising the money for it. So unless someone makes a massive donation of funds to, you know, get that effort moving, I wouldn't really expect to see that happen.
Okay. I would also at this time like to invite our listeners to join in. I would like to know what you think. Do you think legislation just such as the DREAM Act will make it tougher to get real immigration reform legislation passed? Or do you think it creates a backlash when it comes to getting real immigration reform passed? You can join in the conversation by calling us at 800-224-8389 or 559-275-8989, or online at kvpr.org. And Dr. Holyoke, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us this morning. I am now going to bring in Mark Kerkorian, who is the executive director for the Center for Immigration Studies. Thank you for joining us this morning.
We're glad to be here.
My question to you on this, the DREAM Act, do you think it will make it harder to get real immigration reform passed with legislation such as this?
Well, you mean the California Dream Act?
The California Dream Act, yes. We're talking
right,
about the California Dream Act.
Which is kind of mislabeled because the federal DREAM Act, the real one, gives legal status to certain students, whereas the California and other state DREAM Acts are really just ways of giving taxpayer subsidies for illegal immigrant students. But I'd have to say I think it probably does make it harder, even for those who want to legalize illegal immigrants, because it demonstrates politically a an unwillingness to enforce the law. And a commitment to enforcing the law is the first thing the public needs to see before it would be comfortable with proposals to legalize illegal immigrants who are already here. I mean, it's kind of ironic, but the way to amnesty is through enforcement, and anything that delays that makes legalization that much less likely, in my opinion.
Okay. Do you think the problem that we look at a lot when it comes to immigration reform is the whole issue of amnesty? Do you think we will ever be able to address that issue?
I think at some point, probably. I mean, the way I envision it, the issue playing out is not the conventional deal of amnesty in exchange for promises of enforcement in the future. That's what's called comprehensive immigration reform, or in 1986, that was the deal that Congress passed. Instead, I think what we're going to see is enforcement without preconditions, enforcement not in exchange for anything, but just on its own, for its own sake. And then, after a period of years, when the enforcement mechanisms are in place, are working, have survived the legal challenges that the ACLU will launch against everything like this, and the illegal population has shrunk more, even more than it already has, then it seems to me there's a potential, at least for a discussion, of legalizing some of those who remain. But that's not going to happen, and shouldn't happen, in my view, until we have consistent across-the-board enforcement that's proven and is working, and we're not there yet. We're not even close to that yet.
Is this always going to be a political issue? That's what it seems to be, because we don't have the enforcement, as you mentioned, and every election cycle we get different proposals, and nothing ever seems to go through.
Well, I mean, it's always going to be a political issue because, you know, we live in a democracy. Education is always a political issue. Everything's a political issue because we deal with our disagreements through politics. The question is, are we, you know, is anything changing? Are we getting anywhere? And I have to say we probably are, because we really have seen an increased commitment to enforcement. It's inadequate still, in my opinion. There's a whole list of areas that I would be happy to go into but won't bore you with now if you don't want to hear it, of things we need to do. But we did make some significant progress, I think, at the end of the last administration in enforcement. And even this administration, while it has dialed back on some enforcement, it's kind of one of those two steps forward and then one step back situations. We're actually moving haltingly, I think, in the right direction. So, yeah, I'm actually optimistic that we're going to do a better job of dealing with immigration. It just doesn't happen overnight, and it doesn't happen as part of some big grand bargain in Congress, which is something Congress isn't really very good at.
Well, what does good immigration reform look like?
Well, it's instead of a kind of comprehensive thing, it's piecemeal. In other words, the first and most obvious thing that we need to do is to pass a mandatory E-Verify law. Your listeners may not be familiar with it. E-Verify is an online system federal government runs to enable companies to determine whether they're being lied to by new hires. In other words, whether the Social Security and the name is real and matches when you hire them instead of find out about it a year or two later. This is a voluntary program now. A lot of people do use it. My own Center for Immigration Studies uses it. Very effective, very quick. It's free for the user. But it needs to be applied to everybody so that there's an even playing field. That, it seems to me, is kind of the most obvious first step we need to take. And, you know, we're getting there little by little, but I think we're going to see that happen. And, and then there are other measures. My point is there's a lot of piecemeal measures like that that need to be put in place before we talk about doing anything about the illegal immigrants who are here already.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kerkorian, for joining us this morning. We appreciate the discussion.
Sure. Happy to do it. Thank you.
And unfortunately, Ruben Navarrete was not able to join us this morning, but we would also like to thank Thomas Holyoke, political science professor at Fresno State, and Mark Kerkorian, executive director, Center for Immigration Studies. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. The recession isn't just hurting families financially. It's creating more stress for parents who already feel overwhelmed by the demands of raising children. Child safety advocates are concerned about the link between the economy and rising reports of abusive head injuries in infants. That condition is better known as shaken baby syndrome. Valley Public Radio correspondent Shelley Bronco has this report.
I know you're hungry, Papas. I know you're hungry.
It's dinner time for Maria Alvarez Garcia and her grandson, Adam Carbajal, in their North Fresno home. She has to spoon-feed him even though he's almost 8 years old. Carbajal can't speak, and he still drinks juice from a sippy cup meant for a toddler. As an infant, Carbajal suffered abusive head trauma, commonly known as shaken baby syndrome. At the time, his mother left him in the care of her boyfriend, who shook Carbajal and slammed him against a hard surface. The injuries left the boy mentally disabled, paralyzed on one side of his body, and prone to seizures. Alvarez Garcia has to take care of his every need.
Sometimes tears come out of his eyes, but he can't express himself, so it's just, like, really hard for me. Like, am I being selfish for wanting him in here? And that's one thing that I always tell God, you know, I don't want him to suffer.
Shaken baby syndrome and other forms of child abuse are on the rise as the economic downturn puts more stress on caretakers. Non-relatives are often the perpetrators in shaken baby cases, but so are inexperienced parents. Last month, a 23-year-old Merced father was arrested on suspicion of killing his infant son. The baby's injuries were consistent with shaken baby syndrome. Esther Franco is the executive director of the Fresno Council on Child Abuse Prevention.
Parents, when they're undergoing economic hardship and during the first year of life, is really when the baby is the most fragile. And so when the baby cries for no reason during the first year of life, parents become frustrated and they shake the baby and the baby's too fragile.
When a baby is shaken, the brain hits the skull as the head moves back and forth, causing hemorrhages and swelling. Dr. Philip Hayden is the medical director for the Child Abuse Treatment Center at Children's Hospital, Central California. He says even if a baby's head hits a soft surface, like a mattress, the effects can be devastating.
When that happens, there's a sudden deceleration, which causes tremendous forces going the other way, and it's almost like when a car runs into a wall. Both can't exist in the same place, so we end up having a compression or crunch or whatever. And I'm not saying that you're necessarily going to get a skull fracture, but you may end up having no injuries on the outside if it's against a soft surface of a bed, or you may have a depressed skull fracture or a complex skull fracture because of the impact.
Poverty is often linked to child abuse. In this month's issue of the medical journal Pediatrics, a national study reported that shaken baby cases nearly doubled in areas with rising unemployment during the recession. Dr. Hayden says the Valley has some of the highest rates of shaken baby syndrome he's ever seen. In 2009, Children's Hospital treated 65 inpatient cases of child abuse injuries. That number rose to 79 last year. As of September, the hospital has already seen 65 cases. Dr. Hayden says abusive head trauma makes up one-fifth of cases each year. The problem is worsened by the Valley's high rates of poverty, unemployment, and drug abuse, especially the use of methamphetamine.
When drugs are there, it tends to take away the ability of a parent, in many cases, to adequately protect a child and may cause behavior problems that could result in a child being injured.
Child abuse prevention has become a driving force for Alvarez Garcia. She helped create Adams Law in California, which makes the permanent injury of a child punishable by 15 years to life in prison. She's also worked with the Fresno Child Abuse Prevention Council to start Adams Project. It's a program aimed at helping new moms cope with stress. Beginning this month, Fresno County birthing hospitals will require new parents to watch a DVD about Adam Carbajal's story and shaken baby syndrome. Franco says parents will also receive handouts describing methods to calm a crying baby.
I'm very excited about this because we've been working on it for almost 3 years, and we want to be sure and give this information to hospitals, 17,000 brochures a year. Make sure you give this to mom and the family. Watch the DVD, and so they'll remember. Once you see Adam's story, you'll remember to never shake your baby, and you'll know what the signs and symptoms are. So when they're crying for no reason, you won't lose your cool, so to speak.
Alvarez Garcia says the man who hurt her grandson will get out of prison in 2015. She wants the public to learn from her family's struggle.
It's very simple. You just walk away. You know, no baby deserves what happens to them. Whatever frustration a parent feels with the child, they don't deserve to be hurt.
She urges parents to remember that a few moments of anger are not worth a lifetime of pain and regret. I'm Shelley Bronco.
And now Shelley joins us here in the studio. Shelley, what do medical professionals say to parents about how to deal with a crying baby? Because you have so many people who just don't know very good parenting.
That's right. Doctors say that crying is a normal phase in the baby's life, all this unexpected, prolonged crying. Parents shouldn't blame themselves. There's also a phrase called the period of purple crying that's out there in the medical community to help parents understand crying. And it's an acronym. PURPLE stands for there's unexpected crying. Maybe they'll cry more in the evening. And crying is really the baby's form of communication, whether they're hungry, tired, or sick. So it's completely normal.
And this new hospital-based outreach that you mentioned in your story to new parents, is it based on any existing program?
Yes. Actually, on the East Coast, there's a doctor in upstate New York named Dr. Mark Diaz, and he started this educational program about a decade ago, and he wanted to keep the message simple and reach as many new parents as possible by taking the program straight to the hospital day one, reaching new moms. And the rate of shaken baby cases there actually dropped 47% after this program was started.
Wow. Thank you, Shelley, for joining us this morning. Also here to further discuss the issue is Esther Franco, Executive Director, Fresno Council on Child Abuse Prevention. And we also have Karen Cooley, Executive Director, Kern Child Abuse Prevention Council, Haven Counseling Center in Kern County. Thank you, Karen Cooley, for joining us, as well as Esther Franco. And first, Karen, my question to you, are you seeing similar increases in shaky baby syndrome cases in Kern County?
Yes, we are. We've seen increased numbers in deaths and injuries in the last year.
Do you also see a link between the economy and the increase in cases?
That's really hard to judge. Although we do know that the economy creates more stress for parents, and stress can lead to child abuse and neglect.
Esther Franco here, the Executive Director of the Fresno Council on Child Abuse Prevention. What do you think about Adam's Law? What kind of impact are you hoping it will have?
Well, the punishment should fit the crime. And so we were very supportive. And as a child advocate is what the council, their main purpose is, we were in favor of it. But we know that education, prevention education, is what is going to stop child abuse, not increasing punishments. But still, I mean, we are, like I said, we're in favor of it.
And your organization, that's what you focus on, is prevention and education.
Yes. There's a state law that every county in California has to have a council that is their primary function is to respond and intervene on matters of child maltreatment, which is child abuse and or neglect. And the FCAP, which is our acronym, the Fresno Council on Child Abuse, serves that purpose. And we're always looking for ways to educate the community on primary prevention. There's three levels of child abuse, where there's primary prevention, secondary, and tertiary. Tertiary, of course, being where the child has already been abused, and that's where, like, CPS would intervene. And so we want to educate parents, which Adam's Project, the SBS prevention is primary prevention. You educate parents on what are the indicators or causes of child abuse, so you prevent them, you help them to care for their children.
Is that a lot of what we're seeing? We know here in the Valley, we do have a lot of teen parents. We have a lot of young parents because of the high teen pregnancy rate. And Karen Cooley, I want you to join in on the answer to this question, too. So is a lot of what we're seeing, is it, you know, parents really just not some of it, you know, some of it you're just going to have bad parents who abuse children, but is some of it people who just lack good parenting skills?
Yes. Actually, the five primary causes of child abuse and neglect are parenting knowledge, mental health, poverty, which is the number one cause, and that is tied in with neglect. The highest form of child maltreatment is neglect, and also substance abuse and sexual predators. But the younger the parent, the higher the poverty rates, the higher the risk escalates. So we know what the indicators are. We know what the risk factors are. And so that's why we target those groups.
Yes. One of the things that really comes through loud and clear is that parents often just don't know the basic ages and stages of what to expect from children at what point in time. Understanding that crying is a basic communication factor in infants, and that that's going to be something that they're going to have to deal with and have to learn coping techniques where that's concerned, is sometimes really difficult for parents to factor in. They also don't understand what a 2-year-old is supposed to do or what a 3-year-old is supposed to do, and so they often have unrealistic expectations of behavior for children in those early years.
And for our listeners, what do you think? Do you think Adam's Law is a good deterrent when it comes to a child abuse, especially cases like shaken baby syndrome? You can call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at kbpr.org. You mentioned, it's not just shaken baby that we've seen an increase in. It's all cases. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, because of poverty, Fresno County, it's 32%, which is one of the highest rates in the nation. But also with neglect comes, for example, safe sleeping. We have issues with that in the Fresno County. A lot of times parents can't afford cribs and they'll sleep with the baby, or they'll put the baby on a sofa, or they'll put it in just a makeshift sleeping area with pillows. And so Fresno FCAP also sits on the Child Death Review Committee. And so we've seen a lot of safe sleeping issues.
Tell us a little more about your outreach and education efforts on shaken baby.
Well, like part of our job, as I explained earlier, was to assess what the needs are of the community. And every county is different. That's why every county has their own separate council. But FCAP finds that in order for us to create a community where we can truly implement primary prevention, we've tripled our mandated reporter trainings. California child abuse reporting law classifies 35 professions as mandated reporters. And these mandated reporters are people who have access to children or work in a profession dealing with children. So we find it's a critical role in protecting children that they are able to recognize and report suspected abuse, because we knew we were having issues when teachers or other people or in daycare were saying, well, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure, so I didn't report it. And it's not your job as a mandated reporter to find out if the child is actually being abused if you suspect abuse. So we changed our information, our trainings to say report suspected abuse. And we've tripled our trainings. We're showing mandated reporters. And actually, I encourage everyone. There are some states in America where everyone is a mandated reporter, which I think is a wonderful law that I'd like to advocate for, because children need protection. And a lot of times the people that abuse them are their own parents or someone they know. That's also a very big misconception like the whole stranger danger. It's not strangers that hurt children. It's someone they know.
Ms. Cooley, Karen Cooley, do you all have any specific education programs targeting shaken baby syndrome?
We do through the Kern County Network for Children, which is our council here in Kern County. And we have a program called Kern Cares, which every month does free trainings for professionals and community members on issues related to children and child abuse and neglect. And so those sessions have been held this year. We have increased our sessions on mandated reporting as well so that we can reach a broader audience and have people be really aware of what are the indicators of child abuse and neglect, how they can report, how not to be afraid to report, how not to worry about having to be the investigator. But as the other respondent was saying, just if you suspect child abuse or neglect, to be able to report that appropriately.
Do you think the education that you've done thus far and just more awareness about the whole issue, are you seeing the public becoming more involved?
Yes, we are. We're seeing an increase in the number of referrals to Child Protective Services, and that does not necessarily mean that there's an increase in child abuse, but that there's an increase in the awareness of the community at large. We often talk about how the victims of child abuse and neglect are often below the radar. They're not in preschool. They're not in daycare. The only ones who really are seeing them are their immediate family and the persons who surround that family, other relatives, friends, neighbors. And so they aren't coming in contact with people who are mandated reporters, but they are in contact with community members, and those community members need to be willing to step up and make a referral when they suspect child abuse or neglect.
Esther, are we seeing the same thing here in Fresno County with the public involvement? Do you think the increase in education has gotten out to the public and that they are becoming more aware of what is child abuse and taking a step to get more involved?
I think that with the stories, a lot of times media will only kind of a little bit over sensationalize the horrific stories of child abuse. The successful stories of child abuse prevention really don't make the papers. It's always the horrific stories. So people become very agitated and frustrated. And in that respect, yes, they do care very much, but we're finding they don't know what to do. And again, the problem we're having is, well, I wasn't sure. And, you know, they don't want to report their neighbors. A lot of time what Karen was saying, it's true. If the children aren't being taken to daycare, they're being kept at home. Neighbors can hear children crying. They can see, you know, children running out barefoot in just diapers in the wintertime. So, again, educating the community on the what signs to look for and children's behavior and dress and whatnot.
So what do you tell the public to look for?
Well, first of all, we're finding that we have to describe that four types of child abuse. There's physical, sexual, general neglect, and emotional abuse, and each one of them has distinctive signs. Physical abuse is easier to detect, but sexual abuse, which we estimate is probably the most prevalent in the cases that we see, because FCAP also interviews the children for allegations of abuse, and about 80% of the cases are for sexual abuse. And so you can't see the signs. You have to look for children's behavior.
Wow. Karen?
Yes, I would agree that that sexual abuse is a very severe problem in our communities. Looking for children's behavior, are they afraid of being with somebody who they normally see in the family? Are they withdrawn? You know, looking for signs and symptoms like that are can be indicators of sexual abuse.
So you can see then where that would be difficult for someone in the public, because you know once you make the allegation, it moves everything forward, and so they could be somewhat hesitant if it's a family or somebody that they know. But still, do you suggest that they still contact someone?
Well, one of the services we offer, and I'm very proud of, is that we do information and referral. I've had grandmothers come to our office and say, this one particular grandmother lived out of state. She was visiting her daughter and granddaughter, and the granddaughter was like 12, 13, and was in those preteen years, which are very hormonal.
Very tough.
And we're talking about serious behavioral changes. And so she came to us and she asked us, is it because she's becoming a teenager? Mom has a new boyfriend. You know, could it be mom's boyfriend? And so the grandmother was really concerned. So we, again, provided information and referral. We have a library. We told her what signs to look for. We gave her some reading materials. We refer them to go online.
And when can we expect this educational campaign involving Shaken Baby with having the videos placed in certain hospitals or doctor's offices? When can we expect to see that kick off?
Well, I'm actually completing the hospital implementation this week. And so after the second phase will be to public health and foster care is also getting them by the end of this month. And then we'll go to pediatricians and OBGYNs. But it's very expensive. I mean, printed materials and getting copies of the DVD. So a lot of times funding will hold us up. But we're just really excited about it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us and to talk about this important issue, Esther Franco, and also Karen Cooley. Thank you both. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. It was described as an historic moment, the publishing of the literary work of a group of Fresno Hmong writers. They had their coming out party this Friday night.
Would you like a program?
It was like a coming out party for the newest group of writers to join the literary world. Amid the bright lights of Fresno's Tower Theater, an event billed as the official launch of the book, How Do I Begin, was held. Fresno writer Mas Masamoto called the publishing of the anthology of poetry and stories written by Hmong Americans in the Central Valley an historic moment.
I think tonight's historic because it's a community capturing their voices, and the voices are allowed to be passed down through story, especially in a book form.
The release of the book comes 7 years after the Hmong American Writers Circle was founded by 29-year-old Burley Vang. It provided a home for writers like 49-year-old Saul Vang. Despite generational differences, Saul Vang said they shared common experiences.
You know, we realized that no one has told our story, and we have to tell it. We have to tell it from our experience, from our point of view, and try to kind of set a trend or try to blaze a trail so that, you know, younger writers coming up, they can say, okay, you know, there's a way to do it. Someone has done it. We can follow.
And they do have stories to tell. Some born here in America, like Burley. Others, like Seoul, born in Laos. He came to America with his family at the age of 12.
I struggled to learn English and struggled through school. Had a lot of difficulties just kind of finding myself, kind of dropped out of college, went to join the army, came back, finished my degrees, and then found out that I really like to write.
Vang went on to become the first Hmong American to graduate with a master's degree in fine arts from Fresno State.
He was one of the featured writers at Friday night's event.
Once, American poets were born in the factories of Detroit, the vineyards of the Great Valley, the haunted plantations of the South. But they were all raised on the plains of Iowa. They wrote about life enclosed by picket fences, children creating kingdoms under apple orchards, tornadoes turning trees into rows of corkscrews, and carrying trout miles out of rivers. Now, here I am, adopted citizen, not rooted in this land, unable to taste the spirit in this dust, to sense its moods in the pollen. How do I begin my song? Where do I enter the chorus when my part is not yet written, when the conductor won't point my way?
Vang believes the release of the book and the recent announcement that a screenplay written by Burley Vang and his brother Abel had won a prestigious screenwriting competition sponsored by the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences are groundbreaking achievements for Hmong American literature.
The open curtain for the group and for Hmong writers in a way.
Well, joining me now are the founders of the Hmong American Writers Workshop, brothers Burley and Abel Vang. And thank both of you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure being here.
Well, first, let me congratulate you both, not just on the publishing of the book, How Do I Begin?, but also on your award-winning screenplay. Now, the screenplay is titled The Tiger's Child. Tell me about that. And when did you two finish that?
Well, it started 3 years ago. I wanted to write a story surrounding the secret war. And for 3 years, we've been writing and rewriting and writing and rewriting it up until this year when we finally submitted our latest draft into the Nickel Fellowship.
Now, this competition was sponsored by the Academy of Motion Picture and Arts and Sciences. So this is a really big deal for you, too.
Yes, it's really big. It's huge. We're still trying to let it sink in.
So are we looking at a possible movie? What happens next?
Well, the fellowship is, we've won 30,000 through this contest. But the big thing is it creates buzz in Hollywood. And so we get a chance to meet producers, agents, film agencies, and
it's opened up a lot of doors, and a lot of managers and agents have contacted us. Some have wanted to represent us. Now, in terms of the script itself, it's actually also in two other competitions right now that we still have yet to hear from. It's also in the Sundance Screenwriters Lab, and we are in the second round right now.
We don't
hear back till December the 15th, and it's also in a competition at the National Endowment for the Arts.
Okay. When you guys first started writing this, did you think this might be the outcome, or were you both, writing because you love to write?
Well, we wrote it because we love to write, first of all, but we were hoping that we would make it at least past the first round. But we knew that competition was going to be heavy.
Yeah, there were how many out of what were you?
Right now, 5 winners out of 6,730 scripts submitted from all over 50 states and 58 different countries.
This is huge. So when do you all are going to go? Are you going to L.A.?
We're going to
Hollywood. Next week.
Yeah, next
You're
week.
You're going to Hollywood. Yeah.
So it's a week paid stay in Hollywood.
And what will you be doing during that time?
Meeting a lot of folks from Hollywood. And then all of that will culminate into a dinner at the end where we receive our prize, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, the two of you were born, both of you were born here in Fresno, right?
I was born in Santa Ana.
Santa Ana.
And I was born here in Fresno.
Okay. But you both went to Edison High School?
Yes.
And then you graduated from Fresno State?
I graduated from Davis, and then I came back.
Oh, okay.
From a graduate.
You both went away to school.
I he my brother went to Davis and came back and did his graduate studies here at State, and I finished here at State and then went and did my graduate studies down at USC.
Well, when did you know that you wanted to write?
I knew early on as a child, maybe in the second grade, I was writing already, and I loved it.
I didn't know until I saw my brother, and you know, after him receiving publication after publication, then you know, finally started to trigger, and I didn't really start taking writing seriously until just about 5 years ago.
Wow. Then what was it like? Because I know when I spoke to Solvang, he talked about it being, because he was more like the first wave or generation of writers, he talked about it being sort of like a lonely experience.
Yes, it's a lonely experience. He was the only other, well, there was one more writer, but it was only him, another writer, Paul Moore, who also read it on Friday night. There were only two that I knew that were somewhat writing in California, and they were Hmong. But I wasn't close to them. I wasn't connected with them. They weren't connected to each other. We were just sort of distant. But yes, it was very lonely because we didn't have a community.
Is that what went into forming the Hmong Writers Circle?
Yes, I felt that I needed to connect with Sol and Ba, and that I felt that there were other Hmong writers out there who were either writing the dark or they were simply not writing because they didn't feel like there was a support from the community. And I had this urge. I had to do something about it. I had to bring us together and create a group, a circle of writers or something, anything just to nurture that.
And what was that like in the beginning?
It was hard. It was tough. I remember going to Fresno State with my fiance then, and we would pass out flyers asking people if they were interested in poetry or fiction or essay writing, and then I would throw these feasts, these potlucks, and just have people come over to eat, and then I would force them to read poetry and fiction.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Is it hard when I talked about like within your own culture, when it comes to being a writer, are there certain expectations or?
I think there are because we didn't have a written, the Hmong didn't have a written language.
You know what? That's what it is. I really wanted to ask you when talking to some of the Hmong writers, and the point is made why this is so extraordinary. Is that the Hmong people did not have a written kind of
tradition.
It mm-hmm. came late at all. And mm-hmm. Explain that to me.
Well, the Hmong, we didn't have a writing system until the 1960s. Prior to that, everything was oral tradition. There's rumors have it that we lost it somewhere in China when we left. And so writing now means a lot because everything has been passed down just orally. And so no stories are really kept. Stories change over time. History isn't written down, so no one knows where we come from in ways we feel like we're not rooted anywhere.
So that's why this is just so significant,
right?
Because you're the first group writing, having a written history of not only your life, but just your talent
mm-hmm.
that hadn't happened before.
No. All you have are just books written by maybe anthropologists, maybe
historians, researchers,
yeah.
Journalists.
But in terms of creative writing, there is only one other Hmong anthology in existence out there aside from ours.
What are you two hoping this anthology will do?
I hope that it'll inspire other members of the Hmong community to pick up the pen and write. If not write, express themselves in other forms of art, tell their stories, don't bottle it up. Not only that, I hope it'll inspire members from other communities to to tell their stories. I think stories are very, very important.
You know, that was one of the things when I spoke to David Masumoto the other night, and he talked about he wished that his parents, when they would have come here, would have written it all down, because he missed having all those stories. And so it does provide that history for a lot of people.
It does. In some ways it does. It's because if we don't write it down, eventually, I mean, it's going to have to be transferred through word of mouth, and I think things get lost.
And Burley, you were, you know, just to note that you have also participated here and read on our Valley's Writers Read.
Yes.
And tell me about the stories that you have written. Where do they come from?
Polar Runs of Tom was the first story I read here. That one was about my family, about a brother who passed away after a week after being born. Very personal story. And then A Necessary Trip is a short story, fictional piece, about a father and son's relationship.
Is that especially, you know, from what I can remember and the stories that I've done in the past on the Hmong community here in Fresno, there had always seemed to be that pull between generations. It was a very tough balancing act for those who were maybe born here in this country, but their parents came here.
It's tough because I think children who are born here with parents that are from Laos or Thailand, I think just from my experience, and I think you feel sort of lost. You don't know where you really stand. You're sort of just floating between two cultures. And you have to find your way. You sort of have to navigate through all that.
Well, you know, any of our listeners, if you have any question for brothers, the Vang brothers, you better ask them now, because they're going to hit the big time pretty soon, I think. And this is your chance to talk to these guys. You can call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at kbpr.org. Are you too prepared, you think, for your next move? Let's say the screenplay that you've written, you still have a Sundance to go. That's a huge, huge thing. You know, do you think you're ready for the next step? A lot of times you have people who've always dreamed about something they want to happen, and then when it happens, they take a step back and say, whoa, are we ready for this?
There's always a question in mind, you know, are we ready? Are we good enough? You know, could we?
Well, I don't know. Don't doubt yourself when it comes to the good enough, you know, but, just about handling the whole thing.
Well, it's, you know, it always takes a moment, you know, for it to really sink in. But, you know, as of now, it's basically the pressure is on. And it's about, you know, now that everybody, you know, a lot of people in Hollywood can see, I guess, the talent in our screenplay. We've had many people request a second, third, and fourth screenplay. So right now it's all about, you know, churning out these ideas, writing out, you know, new screenplays. And within the past week, you know, Burley and I have been jotting down as much as we can on paper.
Let me ask you something. Do you all think the movie with Clint Eastwood, Gran Torino, really kind of help move the Hmong community forward as far as people having a better understanding and a better idea of the Hmong people who mainly many reside here in the Central Valley?
I wouldn't say that. Well, I would say that Gran Torino definitely did put us on the map for those, because, you know, living in L.A. for the past 3.5 years, no one knew who I was. You know, when they come, when my classmates, colleagues, or professors would ask me, you know, what am I? And I tell them I'm Hmong. They have no clue. but at least Gran Torino sort of, you know, put it somewhere on the map and, you know, made us known. But the portrayal of Hmong, you know, that's a different story.
Right.
But at least, you know, just putting us out there on the map, you know, I guess, you know.
But I think that's almost with – you talk about the portrayal of Hmongs, but that's almost with every ethnic group. You have to go with how Hollywood or society portrays
yes.
you.
Yes.
And perhaps that's why it's so important when you have two young people like yourself doing what you're doing.
Right. Yes, that's true. And I think that's one reason why we wrote the screenplay. That's one reason why I write instead of having people portray my character or who I am. I would rather tell my own story and do it justice.
That's great. How has the younger community here in Fresno reacted to both of you, having you here?
I think just from what we've heard, I think everybody's really excited.
There's a lot of support from
a lot
the community.
Of support, but that means a lot of pressure on us.
A lot of expectations.
But I think we're fine with that.
What's next for the Hmongs Writer Circle? Where do you want that to go?
At the moment, we are still going to discuss that, but we are doing more readings. We were just waiting for this book launch to happen. We're booking readings across California right now. So we'll see where that goes. And then we're just really working on our own individual projects, in our own books. And that's where I think where we're headed as of now, to become our individual writers, artists.
The book. Where can people get the book?
They can order it from Heyday. In Berkeley, at heydaybooks.com or heyday.com. Mm-hmm. You can also get off Amazon. I believe the Barnes & Noble here carry the book.
Okay. Well, that's good. I can't wait to hear about what's next from both of you. I'm excited for both of you, and thank you both for joining us this morning. Burley Vang and his brother, Abel Vang, and pay attention and listen and see where these two bright young men end up. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
And we'd like to thank you for joining us this morning for another edition of Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.